Hello and welcome back. Hit Factory here. Just Aaron on this side today, but I'm joined by some phenomenal guests. Today I've got two very talented filmmakers and the hosts of To the White Sea, a podcast exploring the work of the Coen brothers through the prism of their unproduced screenplay, To the White Sea. It's Jordan Fish and Ray Tintori. Gentlemen, welcome to Hit Factory.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Super excited to be here.
With Carly out of commission today, it's great to just, you know, when the cat's away, the boys will play, they say. So it's good to have just kind of a dudes episode. And we're going to be talking, as we always do, whenever the ladies off the mic, about a real kind of guy movie, I guess.
Yeah, we need Carly to have the second act break and the first act break to motivate the story and really like perpetuate the plot forward.
Is this is a triple hander, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Two boys, one lady.
Exactly that. Yeah, normally we would need, you know, the feminine perspective to do all the scheming, because the three of us, I think we like to consider ourselves men of culture, but also maybe a little bit soft, right? We're maybe a little weak-willed, and we need that impetus. We need that kind of coercion to follow through with our plans and really see ourselves into riches, I suppose.
Well, I may not have big muscles, but I'm very brave, you know? Seriously.
Aaron, have you been talking to my psychiatrist?
Yes, your shrink calls me up, and we discuss. It's like Don Draper with Betty's shrink, where he just gives him a call at like 11 o'clock at night after the house is asleep, and we just go through it. I take notes, I make suggestions and recommendations, and winds up being very effective for all of us.
Things were so much easier back in the day.
All right. We'll try to tamper down and keep the misogyny to a minimum.
I'm actually today. Very nice. Okay, this is like the worst I've ever been.
Well, gang, let's just get into it. For the show today, I decided, gentlemen, to get you to step outside just a little bit, just step outside of your usual milieu. Not too far, though, because today we're going to be discussing, for the very first time on this program, I might add, director Sam Raimi, a friend and frequent collaborator of the Coen brothers, and his bleak, icy Midwestern neo-noir, A Simple Plan.
Look at this.
Just like we found lost treasure. We're like Robin Hood.
You want to keep it?
Sometimes good people do evil things.
Part of that is my money.
Like there's two sides now.
You're my brother.
Bill Paxton.
You gotta make this look like it was an accident.
Billy Bob Thornton.
What do I get?
Bridget Fonda.
He's gonna shoot you both.
From the New York Times best-selling novel.
Get to your back!
A Simple Plan.
I wish somebody else had found that money.
So, fellas, let's just start with a simple question. What do you guys think of the film? Is it the first time for either of you? How do you feel about Sam Raimi's 1998 film, A Simple Plan?
We just pointed at each other. I watched the film for the first time yesterday, and I had a really nice experience with it. I enjoyed it. I thought the tension was through the roof. I think it's a really balanced genre picture with a lot of ins and outs. And I think in a lot of ways it is similar to Fargo on a surface level, but I also think that it's probably, I think, way more novelistic than the Coen brothers probably would do. Yeah, and reading about the way it was sort of developed over the years, the fact that the screenwriter was the novelist, at least for certain drafts, and the original draft was like 265 pages. It definitely feels like a movie that has a lot of kind of backstory to its characters and then kind of got maybe whittled down to something. So yeah, I enjoyed it. There's a lot there. I have some questions about certain parts, the main thing for me is Billy Bob Thornton and Bill Paxton give phenomenal performances, and the performances are really the spine of the movie, and that's exceptional and really, really carries the movie the entire way through.
Yeah. Okay. So I saw this movie when it first came out. And I remember very clearly seeing it at that theater. It's on like 15th Street in Prospect Park. Now it's a Nighthawk, was the Pavilion. Saw it on like a very small screen in the back of the Pavilion. And, you know, was excited. I remember going to see it, really being ready to like it. I had seen Affliction, which was a film that came out that year also, that kind of was in a similar vibe. And this was more fun, a more fun movie than that. And I definitely remember the two things. This was the first time I watched it in total. The two things that have stuck with me, or that stuck with me the most in high school, is like when he shoots the Lou's wife and she flies into the wall. I've gone back and just watched that scene, how that scene works, like over and over. It's always like, I remember, like, if you really want something to be good, like, go look at that scene, because that's like one of the best things ever. And then the talk that Billy Bob gives about that girlfriend that he had in high school for 1 month, that definitely lingered with me like crazy. Like the fact that he's like, it was cool, you know, she was kind of like one of the nicest people I've met in my life, actually. And yeah, just had like a rad time watching it. My love for Sam Raimi has only grown over the years, so it was really, really fun to watch it and then think about how this fits into all his movies. And then, yeah, to think about it as all the things that the Coens wouldn't do that are happening in this film, and kind of because these people come from the same kind of primordial place. Like Joel Coen is in the editing room of Evil Dead 1, which is just like such a homemade movie. Like they start out at that like raw place together. And yeah, this compared to Fargo, I think would be really, really interesting to get into. I'm super excited about that.
Is this Sam Raimi's best feature? And it's so distinct and different. Ray's shaking his head definitively no, this is not Sam Raimi's best feature.
No. He directed The Quick and the Dead and Spider-Man 2. I would say it's like top. It's hard to say which one of those is the best, but I would say it's very, very top tier. But those movies are incredible. Quick and the Dead is incredible. And Evil Dead 2, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Is incredible. That's an incredible film. This is not as good as Evil Dead 2. It's really, really good. But come on. Do you want to live in a world with no Evil Dead 2 or no Simple Plan?
Yeah. I think I agree with you wholeheartedly there, Ray. There's something just so I don't know. It's so distinct about Evil Dead 2 specifically. It's so it's so singular, and when you watch it, you just kind of marvel at the ingenuity of it, of the skill on display, just how much fun they're having in every one of those frames.
This made me think a lot about Spider-Man and a lot about like Quick and the Dead, and even like what's so impactful about Evil Dead movies is like Sam Raimi is really good at directing dialogue drama scenes and making you care about characters. And I think this movie just allows you to really sit and just like look at how good this guy is at just doing dialogue scenes, and remember how good the dialogue scenes in the Spider-Man movies are, you know, and how much you care when Leonardo DiCaprio dies in Quick and the Dead. And he's just like very gets you really emotionally rooted, you know, and I think that often you don't focus on that when you think about him, but this movie is a great way of just really, really seeing it.
Yeah, I think this movie is a really interesting exercise in restraint for Raimi. I read something that he said, I was excited about this movie because it wasn't really about shots. It's more about the dialogue and the connections between the characters. And certainly there is a lot of great formal stuff in this movie. I mean, like the interior of that plane and the crows, the fucking dog going through the window is like such pure Raimi. Like it's like the goat in Drag Me to Hell.
Yes.
But those moments are kind of punctuating overall, like this sort of flat, like more opaque, snowy surface of the movie. And so it's mostly about character stuff. And I think one thing that's interesting about it compared to the Coens is the characters really chit chat a lot, and they kind of talk around what they're getting at. The dialogue feels a lot looser and more improvisational. And it just feels like its own thing for sure. To me, it was interesting how it was less about the specificity of like 80s Minnesota and the accents and all that cultural detail, and it was more about kind of like sort of like 90s. I don't know if it actually took place in the 90s, but it felt like a movie that had that sort of background, kind of yuppie conversation going on about like who gets to go to college, who gets to have the suburban American dream, and who gets to kind of like, you know, live in the past and have to sort of deal with the consequences of other people's social mobility. So, you know, very interesting conversation going on in the background of this movie. Yeah, I think it's well drawn. I think it's well rendered. Like when Paxton says, "You work for the American dream, you don't steal it." Mm. That kind of feels like some kind of like thematic statement of the movie. And yeah, I mean, like, is that like in the morality of Bill Paxton's character, or is the movie like kind of questioning that by the way that he's this sort of family man guy who's also able to murder people when he needs to? Right. You know, I think that's just an interesting aspect of the movie. Like Ray and I have talked about Unforgivable protagonists. We did an episode about that. And I think it's interesting also to see it through the lens of that. And I don't know, I'm kind of like unspooling like maybe too much, but like, I think the way that that aspect of the movie is kind of countered by the ransom subplot and the, like the fake FBI agents, spoiler. It's kind of wild actually. Like the fact that there's a whole ransom subplot that's not really in the movie. It's just talked about and kind of happened before the movie started. But
yeah, I mean, it's a windy kind of feature where there's like a lot of textures going on, just sort of, you know, kind of ancillary to the main thread in the plot. And it's filled with a lot of this kind of just, I don't know, this sort of atmosphere of an era, of a place. We've already, you know, kind of brought it up, and not just because Raimi is a frequent collaborator of the Coens, but because these are two, you know, kind of snowbound neo-noirs right here in sort of like the mid to late 90s. This film's reputation is sort of probably unfairly like grafted onto Fargo's as well, and kind of considered to be sort of like the lesser of two films in conversation with one another, I suppose. I say lesser only because of the sort of acclaim and recognition and the broad success of something like Fargo. But I actually find the milieu of A Simple Plan to be a lot like thornier and more intricate, where, you know, Fargo is for all of its kind of bells and whistles and the fun that it's having with this kind of cultural place setting, like a pretty austere film in terms of like what the Coens are used to doing. It's a pretty kind of cut and dry, very simple sort of mechanics. And, you know, it's very well crafted, very tightly scripted. I think the formalism on display is really impressive. But it's a movie that at its heart sort of, I don't know, has this kind of very simplistic moral center about like the inherent goodness of a certain type of like hardworking, honest, heartland American. And this film, A Simple Plan, takes that conceit, takes that sort of archetype, and just dissects it and shows you that there is still this like poisoned core at the center of it, that even this sort of notion of these upstanding, honest, hardworking individuals like are infinitely corruptible.
Yeah, I think it's complex. The statement on happiness is complex because at the beginning of the narration, he's like, "I had it all. I had a perfect life." But anytime you peel a little under the surface of these Midwestern characters, which are like who are reserved in realistically, like Raimi's from Michigan. I feel like he like authentically brings Midwestern kind of psyche to the film. They're, like Bridget Fonda is like, she starts to imagine her life if they just were normal people. And it's like, she can't, it's horrible. You know, like when she really is honest about it, she's like, this is a nightmare. We're going to live through a nightmare that's going to last until we die. You know? And it's like the dad killed himself for money. You know, that was the only way that he could really think to make money eventually was to like sacrifice himself. And yeah, it's like, it's no good. Like it really is like everyone is truly trapped in this film and not satisfied in a way that like that opening little, like walk down the street, say hi to little kid thing, I think is more representative of like Bill Paxton's delusion than it is the kind of the core, you know?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the film steadily reveals that, you know, you have that kind of opening voiceover where he says, for a little while, I had everything. I had all the keys to happiness, all the things that my dad said, you know, were the things that would make a man happy. We realize that that is like revealing of, like you said, a delusion, maybe a certain level of like sociopathy. And, you know, that kind of like, that ice cold like knife in the back of learning that, you know, his foundation in that idea of happiness from his dad is a falsehood as well, because he fucking killed himself. You know, like he committed suicide because he was struggling against all of these socioeconomic forces, all of these things that he couldn't get his head above. And it's a very bleak film, you know, even if it starts kind of in that very archetypal, very simple kind of aw shucks Midwestern sort of place.
Something that I noticed that was an interesting complication for Hank is that he knows everybody. Yep. And every time like a random stranger comes up to him, they'll be like, "Hey, Hank." And like, he's not the mayor necessarily, but he's sort of this quasi important person in town. And like, that's obviously something that he's cultivated and, you know, in other times would be proud of, like, yeah, he's like a bookkeeper at a mill, but he's also sort of this educated guy who's there to, I don't know, like just be a decent person. And it's just interesting that then that becomes this major problem for him, because if anybody sees him at any of these various like crime scenes that he gets himself caught up in and has to manipulate, they're going to know exactly who he is. Like it's you, it's your brother. I'm going to call the police. You're done. So like, there's just something about the fact that he's like not anonymous that, I don't know, kind of in like a plot mechanical way, like plays into this theme of like, you know, his status.
Thanks. Tore your coach.
Oh my gosh, God. I know. Oh my God. What? Look at this.
Shit.
Oh my God. How much you think is in here?
God almighty. These are $100 bills. The whole bag's full of them.
Is it real money, Lou?
Hell yes, it's real. Don't be stupid.
What would somebody be flying around with this kind of cash?
You know what? I bet it's drug money.
That's probably what it is. This guy's a right. Dope dealer, because see, that's what they do. They fly around these little planes.
This is dirty money.
That's right.
So 2020.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dirty money, what do you mean? It's like, what are you talking about? It's counterfeit. Dirty money.
Oh, no,
dirty
no. No, this is real.
Whatever it is, it's a police matter now. What do you think we should do? Somebody should stay here. Somebody should go after the cops.
What?
How you want to work it?
Let's think this through.
What?
Hold on. What if we didn't turn it in?
You want to keep it? He wants to keep it. Well, that's a hot one.
Why wouldn't we?
Why? Because it's stealing.
Stealing? Yeah. Stealing from who? From him? Hell, he won't mind.
Oh, because he's dead, right? That's pretty funny. He's dead. He won't mind. Right?
I said we take this bag back to the truck and we pretend like we were never here.
Fuck yeah. Why not?
Why not? Because we get caught. That's why.
Hell. Come on. Well, I'll tell you what. Stay the hell out of it then. You know, we don't need you. It'd just be more money for us.
I don't want to stump you another fancy word, Lou. Does the term accomplice mean anything to you? Come on, that's stupid. Somebody's bound to be looking for it. When they find that plane and the money's not in it, no, that's not bullshit. They're going to come looking for us.
Bullshit. This is dirty money. And as far as that guy's concerned, the cops don't even know he exists. Nobody knows about this but us.
See there? Right?
It's the American dream in a goddamn gym bag. He just wants to walk away from it.
You work for the American dream. You don't steal it.
Then this is even better.
So, Mike Nichols, Ben Stiller,
yeah,
John Dahl, John Borman. Question: what do all these things have in common? Everybody knows that they're motherfucking monsters. No, it's that they were all at one point attached to this script. It's fun to just kind of go down the line here and picture each of these fellas helming this particular script, this particular story. I mean, Dahl feels like the one that's the most like of a piece with Raimi, you know, doing Red Rock West, The Last Seduction. Like, this is very much in his wheelhouse. But just imagining like what kind of movie, like a John Borman, Simple Plan would be, is always fascinating. Or Ben Stiller, you know, because he's coming off of what, Reality Bites at this point. This is, I mean, you know, he's, I think, since proved himself capable in this sort of kind of atmosphere and storytelling with later period stuff that he's done, like Dannemora and Severance and all that kind of stuff. But at the time, it didn't really feel necessarily like something that would even attract a guy like him.
Totally. I was thinking about Dannemora for sure, like that he would go maybe to that mode that's so well directed. He's such a fascinating director. I think if you look at all his films together, they're basically perfect, depending on how you feel about Zoolander 2 and Mitty, Walter Mitty. But he also, just from people that have worked on his projects, I mean, some of the wildest process stuff I've ever heard. Like, the guy does not find like a straight pathway to making those movies. But I think what ultimately, I think he would have clobbered this, honestly. I think he would have clobbered
it. Yeah. It's actor brain in a director's seat, right? Maybe we get Tom Cruise in a fat suit years before Tropic Thunder in this film.
Tom Cruise as Jacob, maybe.
But thinking about, like, yeah. Dannemora is a triple hander, right? And it's so brilliantly cast. You know, it's like, that's one of the coolest casts to put together in that year, I think, to be like Dano and Del Toro and Patty Arquette, you know? So it's like, I feel like Ben Stiller putting this together in 1998 would have, I mean, it's hard to beat Paxton and Billy Bob Thornton. And that was actually, isn't that Mike Nichols' contribution to the project? Is that what the Wikipedia said?
If I remember correctly, Borman was the one who brought on Paxton and Billy Bob Thornton.
Seriously?
Because he took the thing almost to like the end of the line, and then it just became a situation where I think it was scheduling conflicts and a couple of like just issues with maybe some budgetary stuff. But he walked, and then by the time Raimi comes on, he doesn't even have a time to do a ton of the pre-production.
Yeah. Just, it was interesting to me, the little tidbit that all of the locations were scouted by Borman. There's something about the locations that feels a little mid-90s, even though it's kind of edging into late 90s. Like, the houses just look a little bit big and a little bit out of step with the characters in one way or another. Like, not distractingly so. But I wonder, like, I do wonder how the movie would have been different if Raimi had a chance to maybe scout the locations.
I mean, the film just, you know, it gestated for so long after the novel initially came out. In large part, I think, just because of the collapse of Savoy Pictures. You guys familiar with Savoy? The one with, like, the triple print of the buffalo, the red and black kind of title card.
What are some Savoy classics in there?
Oh, man. I thank you for asking, Ray. I was gonna ask if you would permit me to walk you through some of their Cracker Jack titles here. Well, the very first one is A Bronx Tale, the Robert De Niro directorial debut.
Chaz Palminteri.
I enjoyed that film.
I like it too. We love Chaz. It's a pretty good one. They go on to produce John Waters' Serial Mom in 1994.
Awesome.
Pretty good movie.
Hell yeah.
Badass. Awesome.
Martin Campbell's No Escape with Ray Liotta, Lance Henriksen.
Yeah.
That game. I love that movie. Yeah. Very hard to get a hold of for reasons, you know, that become evident when you kind of see the end of this. And then they start taking some big swings and start releasing stuff like The White Man's Burden in 1985. you guys know The White Man's Burden?
This is Harry Belafonte and John Travolta in a film where basically the white people are the, like, basically switch like the social dynamic between white people and black people, right?
That is 100% correct. Yeah. Yes, Ray. It is a sort of race swapped like action thriller that
with Belafonte.
Sliders episode.
And like post it's like post Pulp Fiction Travolta, right?
It is. It's during Travolta's sort of very short-lived renaissance post Pulp Fiction, where he does a couple of you know, bangers like Broken Arrow. Gets to do a John Woo feature. But he also does this. He not too long after this will wind up bringing L. Ron Hubbard's classic Battlefield Earth to the screen.
He did Face Off too.
He did do Face Off. That's right. He did a couple of John Woo features.
But then there's like Michael, and there's the one where he's like got a brain tumor that makes him be able to move objects with his mind.
Phenomenon. We were talking about that one recently too. Yeah. I always got that movie like cross-pollinated and confused as a kid with Contact, because they both kind of start with like, oh, you know, like strange supernatural happenings and whatever. Jodie Foster and John Travolta do not look very much alike. That's not what I'm trying to say here. But in my mind, before I followed up and checked those movies out later on as like, you know, a cognizant adolescent, I assumed that the answer to the phenomenon was aliens, that he had been abducted. And then to find that it was actually about him being the most special boy because he was dying of a brain tumor was a shock to me.
I kind of got it confused with K-Pax.
Yeah, that one is well, again, also a, you know, mental illness, you know, disability / alien abduction plot. So maybe that's the... that's the linchpin of all of this. Is it's one where, you know, a man with some sort of you know, cognitive disorder thinks himself an alien. Interesting. Interesting. Yeah,
maybe there should have been like a magical or alien subplot in this movie. I guess that's the thing about the Coens, though, is like they can add something like that to A Serious Man, and or not to A Serious Man, to the Man Who Wasn't There.
Yeah.
And still have like a consistency of tone or like a clarity of vision. Not that Raimi doesn't add some kind of balls out stuff to this movie, but you know, like I didn't even realize it was an Elfman score, for example. Like it's like not bombastic. It's not like there's not a lot of like swing.
Yeah, it doesn't have a ton of kind of like characteristic Elfman trademarks, I would say. But, you know, when you see the name in the credits, it's not surprising as you kind of clock it. And I think the score does quite a bit in this film. It's got a little bit of that kind of like Southern Gothic kind of twang to it a little bit. Those like guitar portions that come in very specific moments really do a lot.
It's got a lot of momentum. It's not very melody driven like Elfman stuff is sometimes, but it really is. It's very spooky. And it's got a lot of really specific sounds in it that are very emotional.
Yeah, maybe I just have to listen to it again. Like maybe I just have to watch the movie again with an ear on the score. Cause for me, it was almost like invisible. Like I just didn't like, I found it effective. Like I found the movie super, super tense, but the score didn't like announce itself to me in the way that often an Elfman score will.
Yeah, well, we sent you a quick time of the work print of the film before it had been scored. It just had the temp music in there. So that might be the reason why you didn't clock any of that. You mentioned that you were listening with quite an observant ear, though, Jordan. Every time you clocked Billy Bob Thornton's character saying the word cool in the film, I noticed mentioned this on Letterboxd.
Yeah, I just, in general, I really think... Billy Bob Thornton's character is interesting because he's so specific. Like his level of learning disability is calibrated. Like I sort of feel like off the you know, coming off of Sling Blade, it feels like he wanted to create a character that was not like just a sort of idiot man child that like had. He was maybe slow in certain ways, but also like he says, like, I observe things. Like there's scenes where his glasses are on and then there's scenes where his glasses are off. And you kind of like you get the sense that maybe Thornton is trying to be like, I want people to know that I look good or that I have like a sympathetic, soulful gaze. Mm-hmm. Like there's just certain scenes where he connects. And like, yeah, just the way that he says like, yeah, that's the cool part about it. That's what's cool about it. I wouldn't say plane if I didn't want him to know about the plane. So that's what's cool about it. Or like just the way that he says cool a few times in the movie, like he almost has like a little like 10% Elvis in the way that he interacts with people, like underneath the glasses, underneath the wig or the hair. I assume it's a wig.
Yeah. I think Jordan, I think you're like exactly right. Just with that he's playing kind of peekaboo, you know, with all the bangs and the glasses and the big hat and the collar. Like when he shows his teeth, I think is a big deal too. Like he was really mm-hmm. controlling the shape of his mouth and whether he looks kind of like innocent or scary, you know, and also just cool. Like I think like he uses the word cool a lot because he is cooler than Bill Paxton, you know,
yeah.
he's like a nicer person. He's groovier. He's had a, I'd say probably a more fun life, you know, even though it's been a lot, there's been a lot of pain in it, you know, I bet.
But, yeah.
But he, him and his friend actually like telling jokes with each other, you know, and they actually have a connection between the two of them. I think he says at some point, like, he's much more my brother than you are. You know, I forget exactly what the line is, but yeah, mm-hmm. he's fascinating. I think his look is incredible, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they ugly him the fuck up in this in certain parts, but you're right. Like he's also like got a little bit of a swagger to him. He's funny throughout. Like I read so many sort of contemporaneous reviews of this and even some retrospectives that say, oh, this movie is, you know, kind of like Fargo with all the humor sucked out of it. And I was like, I don't know about you guys, but I thought a lot of this movie was quite clever and often funny. And most of it was Billy Bob Thornton and just sort of his like little asides. There's one that, I was watching this with Carly, though she's not here today, and they're talking about the sort of omnipresent crows that are in the film, you know, always sort of there signaling kind of this looming sense of death and the presence of doom just over the horizon. And I can't remember if it's Bill Paxton, it's probably Brent Briscoe, Lou, who when they're, you know, kind of walking through the woods chasing after the dog before they find the plane, say... He says, the crows are always there just kind of waiting on something to die. And Billy Bob says, it's kind of a weird job, isn't it? Like just ascribing this, like, you know, this occupation to these crows, like, oh, like it's their job to just sit there and wait for something to die.
I gotta say, I found like when he's peeing in the snow, right? And Billy Bob runs up and is like, hey, let me help you, you know? Not in the script. In the script, he's just peeing in the snow. I think Billy Bob added that.
He says, like, let me get Dr. Johnson out, say hi or something.
Oh, yeah.
But that's like, well, I really think that's Billy, that's Academy Award winning screenplay, you know, writer Billy Bob Thornton adding like the core thing about his character to the script, which is just like, if someone's writing their name in the snow, he'll be like, yeah, I'll do it too, you know, because he can hang. Yeah. He can actually like see what other people are doing and kind of like mirror them. And not be like a super strident. I don't know. Paxton is so kind of hairless and cruel in this film, you know, and Billy Bob has these bangs and all these kind of like soft fabric on him.
There's a movie I wish I'd had a chance to watch before we spoke, but definitely going to check it out. It's the Carl Franklin movie, One False Move,
mm-hmm.
which Billy Bob and Paxton are in together.
Yep. He does One False Move with his collaborator, Tom Epperson, which is a fantastic film. Great Carl Franklin, like Southern neo-noir, also responsible for directing Devil in a Blue Dress, which we just covered with Will Menaker during Denzember last month. Go check that one out. He and Epperson will go on to write a film called The Gift, that stars Cate Blanchett, that Sam Raimi will direct in the year 2000. So this collaboration proved pretty fruitful for, I think, everyone involved. I also noticed when researching that Nichols, when he was originally attached to this, stepped away in order to pursue working on an adaptation of All the Pretty Horses, the Cormac McCarthy novel, which I don't know if you all have ever seen it before, but winds up being produced and directed by Billy Bob Thornton. So like he had his hands in all the pies at this point in time and just found a way to make it like kind of a crux of so much creative output for several years following this film.
One more great Billy Bob costume detail that I love is I love when he comes into the house like sort of like he cleaned up nice and he's got those pants that are just way too long. He's got like they're like these corduroys or these sort of olive green pants and they're just way too long. It just reminded me so much of trying on clothes in the 90s. Like,
yeah.
Like at Nordstrom.
Yeah. They're enormous. You get the sense that like they're his dad's pants that like he doesn't own these clothes, right? Like he's just not someone who would ever wear anything or be in an environment in which he would have to like dress up at all. He's always in his hunter's like plaids and his snow boots and, you know, his big like ski bibs and his hats. You know, he never has to do this sort of thing and make himself presentable.
Yeah, I was thinking about Nordstrom's or Nords. Did your parents always add like a apostrophe S onto stores that didn't have apostrophe S?
Absolutely.
Or then like Trader Joe. Like Trader Joe's has the apostrophe S, so then it's Trader Joe.
Yeah, it's important as like an adult and I think a parent of children to get the names of businesses and brands just perpetually wrong always.
Slightly off. But no, anyway, like I was like, yeah, I was thinking about Nordstrom, but you're actually probably, it's probably more interesting to imagine that he like got them out of his dad's abandoned dresser.
Ray, you mentioned already, Thornton is, I think he is the heart and soul of the film. He is the most like moralistic character out of all of them here. And he gets some of the absolute best scenes. The one we mentioned already where he's recounting to Paxton, you know, this story about them in high school or whenever it was that, you know, this girl that he supposedly went steady with for like a month was just doing it so that she could win $100 in a bet from all of her friends. That's like really brutal. And did you guys clock that kind of felt like Kaufman lifted it for adaptation as well?
I have that written down, Charlie and Donald Kaufman, it being such a similar scene. A scene I think about a lot, and like maybe the first time you watch the movie, you're like, oh, the point of this is that it's a schmaltzy scene that like Charlie would never write. But I think maybe when you watch the movie a few times, you're like, this is actually Donald showing like what he's good at, kind of. Mm-hmm.
That blows my mind thinking about this in relation to adaptation. And when I think of adaptation, I think of True West, you know, and then I go to like Mice and Men, you know, and just thinking about like even if they're not like brothers by blood, these like movies was two boys, you know, and one's more put together and the other is like a little bit falling apart for like whatever reason it is. They're less polished. Can you guys think of any other like ones like that? Or
yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to think. I mean, Of Mice and Men is the like, you know, the ultimate example of the kind of premise and theme that they're dealing with here. And what I like so much about A Simple Plan is that it takes that and implies that the Lenny character is actually totally aware of his condition.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not like a sort of like putting them out of their misery kind of situation where they're like they're incapable of conforming to this life or this environment or like the kind of progression of civilization, whatever, what have you. It's like with Billy Bob in that role, even before, spoiler, he dies at the end of the film, he is something of kind of like a Christ figure in the life of Paxton, in the life of Hank, where his predicament, his entire existence is the result of shouldering all of the burden of modernity, of existence, of the familial order that they experienced growing up, and sheltering him from all of the harsh realities of the world. That like he is totally fucked up by reality so that Paxton gets to continue to observe and live in his fantasy.
Yeah, it's kind of a revisionist Of Mice and Men, and like maybe the fact that the original saying was I don't know, is it Shakespeare where it's the best laid plans of mice and men often go awry? Like best laid plans, a simple plan. Like there's got to be some connection there, right?
Yes, I think that you're correct, Jordan. And on the subject of Shakespeare, this film also seems to strike an interesting parallel with the tragedy of Macbeth as well. You get Bridget Fonda in this very much like a Lady Macbeth kind of character who's, you know, kind of conniving, sort of pushing her husband into all of these machinations, all of these plans, all of these things that he otherwise probably would not have the gumption, have the stones to follow through with, but also inevitably the situations that result in all of the bloodshed throughout the film. Besides the fact that she's a Macbeth character, I loved, you already called it out, Ray, the scene where we kind of realize that she's not very happy in her existence, that, you know, even though she kind of plays like the sort of like doting kind of like housewife, and you know, she's in love, and they have this perfect relationship, they've got a baby on the way, they've got everything that they need. That scene where she just kind of eviscerates Paxton, and, you know, like talks about the nightmare of living the way that they're living and having to always, you know, count pennies, and when they go out for a nice occasion, they skip the appetizer, they come home for dessert. It's fucking brutal.
I think the most brutal part is when she's like, I'm going to have a fake smile plastered on my face 8 hours a day, you know, and it's just like, I'm pretending to be happy a lot of the time when I'm not. And I'm going to silently suffer through this. And there's no end.
Yeah, it feels like that scene is important setup for the ending, because if you didn't have her sort of lay that all out, like whether or not it's self-involved, you know, or not, it's very, very real and observed. And if you didn't have that scene, I think at the end of the movie, you might be like, well, they're kind of just back where they started, you know. Obviously horrible things have happened and he lost his brother, but like, you know, did these characters experience enough consequences for their actions? But I think because they have that scene in the middle of the movie and Bridget Fonda plays it so well, and they kind of repeat those scenes of her with the books and him messing around in the mill, it hits pretty hard. Especially the ending, with him looking at the farmhouse.
It's funny that, you know, the kind of structure of the narrative is Fonda coming up with a new wrinkle that she kind of like observes in their very simple plan that needs addressing, and then sending Paxton out to do it. And then he'll come back and report. And every single time you realize that she is the person who has, like, she's playing like 12D chess, you know, she has like 10 questions for him where she's like, well, you know, after they kill the farmer, she's like, well, was there any blood? Did you guys leave any tracks anywhere? Like, was there anything, you know, did anyone know he was out there? Like, she has thought of all the angles and she's cased the entire thing out in ways that like Paxton just is incapable of. And every single step along the way, you realize like, she had just kind of gone out and done this herself. It probably would have been extremely clean. She would have like gotten out of this no problem.
That on the second, on this watch, it's one of the things I love about this movie the most is the moments where you start to realize that the characters are thinking way ahead of where you, of where you're placing them just by observing them from the outside. Like the second scene that I think is the killer Billy Bob scene is when he's being put up to get his friend to say the incriminating stuff and be taped.
Yes.
And he starts to get so angry at Paxton for being just such a shit and just treating him like crap his entire life, and really starts to lash out with him. And it's really scary because you think he's about to completely just give him up. And his, maybe his heart allegiance is with his friend rather than his brother. But then at a certain point, you're like, oh my God, he's really just maneuvered his friend into the perfect position to not understand what's coming.
Yeah. You know?
And you're like,
I didn't catch that. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. And it's just like, I feel like Fonda is constantly revealing herself to be like, her brain is moving way faster. She's got these multi-step plans that she can just lay out. Paxton reveals himself to be like a murderer, like over and over again, you know? And Billy Bob does observe things. You know, he knows his dad is dead. He understands that that girl was like just doing it because it was a bet, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's very revealing in that scene, just the way he turns on a dime and even, you know, kind of fleeces Paxton for a moment. He thinks that this is the end game here, like where all of a sudden, you know, he's on one side and Billy Bob and Briscoe are on the other. And then that pivot and just that like knowing look that Paxton gives to Billy Bob when he realizes what he's done. He's doing that kind of stuff constantly in the film. And he's also just like, we've talked about this already, you know, like him being sort of like the moral center of the story, but he's also like, in this largely just as like kind of as part of like his devotion to his brother. Like, he's not a greedy guy the way that like the other guys are, you know, like Lou needs the money to like settle debts and to, you know, get himself up out of the hole. Paxton wants it, I think, because, you know, he's realizing and recognizing that at the core of himself, there's this sort of desire to have much more than he has, that he's not really as happy as he thinks he is. Billy Bob just wants to like get the farm back, you know, like that scene with him talking about like the fake girlfriend he had also starts because he's, you know, kind of discussing maybe having the money presents for him an opportunity to like finally meet a girl and start a family of his own, that like someone could like put up with, you know, the way he looks and how he's kind of slow and the way that he is if he's rich. And you realize that like all of his motivations just stem from this desire to like feel a sense of belonging again, you know, like to free himself of his isolation. And it just becomes even more kind of stark and brutal by the end when you realize like that's all he wants is just to like feel some sort of familial connection with somebody.
Just to say it, he does knock the guy over the head with the tire iron. So like just everything you're saying is valid. I will say that he also does mess up a couple times in a way that feels like, you know, probably would have been better if that hadn't happened.
The crazy thing about it though, Jordan, is like he knocks him on the head with the tire iron and then is like, oh, but like we gotta fix him, you know, like and yeah. Seems genuinely confused about the cause and effect. Like both when he shoots his friend and when he hits the guy with the tire iron, he like rushes to their body like he's confused about the fact that they're dead because of what he just did.
Yeah, like what happened.
Yeah, and then it's like, then compare and contrast that with like that shot where you can just see the guy's eye and Paxton is just like smothering him. And it's like, you are trying to kill this guy, you know? Like in the most intense, like every time Paxton kills someone, it's like, I'm shooting you point blank. I'm shooting you in the back. I'm holding your nose until you die. Or it like, I guess he shoots that lady. I mean, one of the most amazing squibs in film history and one of the most amazing like stunt rope pulls when she goes flying. Oh my God.
And another just pure Raimi moment that just like pops out. The lighting too, the way that the scene like gets so like the way that the angle is so high and the way that the room lights up and then she just gets like thrown onto the sink is incredible.
I understand that both of you are maybe regular readers of American Cinematographer. Is that right?
My brother is an editor at American Cinematographer.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, there you go. That's so you have to say yes to that question.
Absolutely.
I'm like a Cinefex completist. I think that's probably the film publication that I've read the most of in my life.
Well, I only ask because there is a pretty good article from American Cinematographer that's talking with Alar Cavillo, the DP here, and talking about
right on.
Just, I mean, it is as specific as, you know, those write-ups tend to be. It talks about some of the setups and, you know, the camera rigs, the film stock that they decided to go with for day shoots versus night shoots because of the speed and just, you know, maximizing the amount of light they can pull in. And I think it's in that article where they mentioned that to get that like really stark lighting in the house, because it was like a derelict house that they took over and set up, that they just had like a Chinese like paper lamp that they would just like move into like particular angles just to get that really low light on it and just get those like incredible like stark shadows and contrast that you get. And it doesn't look like anything else in the movie. Like it feels like a real like heel turn in the entire rest of the film, where it's like, oh, this is where shit is going down. It's just such a palpable like tension in that scene.
It's pretty remarkable that was shot on location. Just feels like a great case for shooting on a set. Just the fact that they shot that at a real farmhouse is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Like the exact same thing happened to them on the set of this that happened on Fargo though, where they got to Minnesota and it was just no snow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great lie perpetuated by literature that Minnesota is perpetually covered in snow. They need to go somewhere nearer to the lakes for that.
Could you guys see the fake like the fake snow plates, like when they're really leaning on it heavy in this movie.
I didn't notice it. Did you clock them, Ray? Yeah,
for sure.
I thought I saw a couple moments where the snow falling felt optical or digital.
Yeah. They're good. They look really good. They're just like,
yeah,
you can tell if you're looking, you can tell.
1998. We're there with some of this stuff.
Yeah. I chose to be, totally bamboozled by it and buy into the illusion every step of the way. The only part where it seemed staged to me is when Brent Briscoe throws that snowball at the fuselage of the plane and all of it falls away to reveal this plane crash. I was like, that, I bet that was set up. I bet they didn't find a plane just covered under snow like that out in the wilderness.
That looks like production design.
it was an amazing gag. I'd love to know how they gagged that up, you know.
Like, yeah.
If it looked real though. Like there's something about like just the way it fell and kind of like had like a sweep to it and felt like really fresh at the beginning, like, you know. It's a lot of setup, a lot of testing.
Yeah. It's real good. I love the, you know, snowballs get hurled a lot in this film, or almost hurled a lot in the film. And I love the, you know, kind of line that that Lou gets really like hung up on with Paxton's character. You know, it's sort of like this thread that Paxton kind of sees himself as somehow like superior to Billy Bob and to Briscoe, where, you know, he's college educated. He's like a normal kind of well-to-do guy. He's got a family on the way. He doesn't drink or, as he mentions later on, like, you know, scream at or, you know, beat around his wife in public or anything like that. But Briscoe pretends to hurl a snowball at Paxton from like, you know, a foot away, you know, point blank range, and mentions like, that's what you might call an insinuating throw. And he's like hung up on this because it was the same kind of shit that Paxton said to him weeks earlier. See, for weeks he's been going home and staying up at night feeling offended by the fact that Paxton had to throw this, you know, $100 word at him. I think he even says like, you could have just said hint. But he doesn't, right? He's always got to kind of get one up on them and show how smart he is comparatively.
I love the scene where they reveal that they're doing impressions of Bill Paxton when he's not there. That really hurts. That really hurts. Where they're like, no, there's like four different moments of you being an asshole that we've canonized into like repeatable, you know, bits. It's like, yeah, we really hate you. Like we talk about how much you suck when you're not here. It's like,
and what's so good about them too is that like they're not good impressions. Like they're just like they're just like gestures. It's like, oh, do the one where the birds attack him in the plane, and Billy Bob just like, oh, he's kind of like, how's it go? He's sort of like, oh, you know, like they're bad. They're not like compelling impressions. It's just like we just sit around and make fun of you for anything that we can mine from your entire existence.
They get his ass. Like it was like, you ever seen a guy hold his whiskey like that? Just look at the way he holds a whiskey. Look at the way
he sips. Look at the way he drinks. Never seen anybody drink like that before.
Did you guys feel at all like any sort of disconnect between the sort of like college boy soft hands characterization of Hank and just like how capable he seems to be at like manipulating a crime scene, coming up with a story? Because like I've just been thinking a lot about the interpretation of the killer movie about like, oh, the point of the movie is that the hitman, he's actually bad at being a hitman because his things mess up a bunch of times. And for me, it's more like that's just realistic. That just makes the movie more believable because a lot of things go wrong when you try to kill somebody. Like I've just been rewatching The Nick also. And I don't think the point of that show is that Clive Owen's character doesn't know anything about medicine, even though his batting average is like 0.005 with his patients. But then like watching this movie, I felt like it's like when in No Country, they make Josh Brolin's character a welder, right? Like he has this like sort of connection to like physical work. that, and they, you know, that sort of sets up his ability, you know, his level of his ability, like his competence. And I don't know, like, for me, it's a little bit of a question, like whether Paxton being able to get away with so much stuff in the movie is a little bit of a, you know, suspension of disbelief, like on ramp or off ramp.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know that I would say that it's like, I don't think that Paxton's an idiot, you know, or like that the movie is even attempting to like kind of reveal like, oh, despite like your educated status or your sense of superiority, that like you're actually totally incapable. I think more of what it is that it's like, it's the kind of cultural cachet that comes along with being an upstanding like member of society, that it comes with being like this kind of, you know, stereotypical working man kind of, you know, in this environment, and being like raised at sort of like the kind of like de facto unofficial like mayor of the town, someone who knows everybody and who says hi and happy new year, and that everyone recognizes, everyone's in their business all the time. I think it's more just like he is good at this. Like, this is actually something that like he would excel at, and that he's just never really utilized his wherewithal or his education or anything for these purposes before, until it comes time to do so and reveals that like, oh, you know, like when given the opportunity, that sense of civility sheds away, and actually those people who we think are like, you know, these sorts of kind of totems of American idealism, they could be sources of profound evil if given the opportunity to do it. I think the same with the killer, you know, like you mentioned, he's not bad at the gig. He's just a bozo, because his like ethos is one thing and his actions are clearly in contraction with that.
How would you guys compare him to like the William H. Macy character in Fargo? Because I feel like that's, if you wanted to actually like find a registration point between the two movies, like the nice husband character who's got a big secret and a big crime he's trying to pull over.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, the Lundegaard character, he's such a fucking sad sap. I rewatched Fargo last night in preparation just to see the comparisons and see if I could, you know, find any of those threads to pull. But I think that the film, the script is considerably meaner to Macy than maybe, you know, Simple Plan is to Paxton. I think the point of that is that he can get his head above and is able to kind of manipulate this. And Macy's character is just, I mean, he's bad at it. He's the guy who like, this is a world that he cannot play in and is just like not capable of reading in any way that seems tactful at all.
I mean, Macy's just losing his shit constantly. Like, he's just, there's so much nervous energy under the surface. Whereas Paxton is, he's playing it cool. And like the scene where he's having his testimony taped, and there's a great shot, by the way, just like a little crane shot of the tape recorder where he and we get a sense of the stakes. And like, to both of your points, like, he said, even though there's this discrepancy between this testimony, he's like, I could see that he would think I was running towards the car. And there's this long pause. And then you see this very, very sympathetic shot of the police officer go, yeah, yeah, I think I do. And it's like, that really answers my question to some extent. It's like they want to get him off. Like, they want to believe him. Whereas I feel like, you know, nobody likes Jerry Lundegaard, right? Like, he's never the high status person in the room.
No, absolutely. He's a total sap. Like, he's just like completely stepped on and overlooked and just like walked over his entire life. And I think like his resentment gets the best of him in so many situations where like he's principled in ways that are often self-sabotaging, whereas Paxton, I think, is a little bit more nimble. You know, he can kind of guard himself. Like, I think specifically of the scene where Macy goes to talk with his father-in-law after he's like, you know, presented this deal to them, and they've misjudged his whole presentation and his kind of position, where he wants to be kind of cut in. You know, he wants them to sort of loan him the money to make the deal himself. And they're like, we're just wanting to give you a finder's fee. Like, we're the businessmen in the room who want to make this deal. You're just the guy who brought it to us. And I think any person who was looking for an easy out or looking for, you know, some opportunity there that is in any way self-serving would probably just, you know, pivot and ask for the money, you know, name a high price and negotiate down. But Macy's not capable of doing it. Macy argues and like bickers and bitches his way into walking out of the door with absolutely nothing and losing the deal to these guys.
Totally. Okay. Just one big difference between the two films is like subjective experience. Like who are the characters you're like subjectively experiencing the film through? And it's like in Simple Plan, I really think you feel it through Bridget Fonda, you feel it through Billy Bob and Paxton, but all the other characters are obstacles or like antagonists coming at them. Mm-hmm. And like a version that was more like Fargo, I think you'd be like, you'd also get this subjective experience of the sheriff or the cop, whoever's like on the case, trying to figure out what really happened. You'd spend time with them, seeing things through their POV. You'd probably spend some time with the fake FBI guy also, who's trying to find the money.
Yeah.
Cause like, that's the thing. It's like the scenes in Fargo where like you get the experience of like, oh, someone just witnessed me doing a crime and now I have to murder them. Like the same stuff that happens in this movie, but you're feeling the tension of that through Steve Buscemi's experience. So you're like, you're kind of hopping from Marge to Buscemi to Jerry. So you're on like opposite sides of this complex situation where like in this movie, it's really like, there's this trio of people who are fairly aligned at the center of this, and everyone else is kind of coming at them.
Yeah, you have to imagine that the 265-page script had a lot more about the ransom and the kidnapping and all that. And maybe those are POV characters too.
Yeah, you kind of assume that it would shift. And I think that that's like the key difference in terms of how these movies are experienced. Where, you know, when I watch Fargo, it's so brisk, you know, it's not a long movie by any standard. It's, you know, like a little bit over 90 minutes and it just moves. Like it feels like it flies by. Every beat feels very well conceived, very calculated for like maximum impact and effectiveness. And it feels like it's kind of dancing around you, and it's there and then over in like a flash. And I think it's because it liberates you from any one perspective. Like it shifts so rapidly that you get the scope of the story, but you're also, you know, working to keep up with it. In A Simple Plan, it's a kind of more patient movie, and it's also a significantly more suffocating film because there is no reprieve from that subjectivity.
Yeah, I think that the tension in this movie is actually all about ebb and flow and kind of false endings and these like momentary respites. Because like there's scenes like, you know, when they do the funeral scene and then you see the baby like kind of shot with this like really like, you know, like blooming out light. And like you sort of get the sense like a few times in this movie that if nobody does anything, the story might end. Like and then like we're kind of, and then we see like Billy Bob like messing around with the shot glasses and you're just like, he's not going to let this go. Or, I mean, also, like, after the whole movie's over, you're like, okay, if nobody had done anything, they would have just gone on a spending spree and gotten caught immediately. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's just an interesting difference, whereas, like, Fargo is just, like, it's just, like, cut, cut, cut. It's like, okay, this is going south over here, and then we cut to the criminals, and they've killed people, too. And then, like, you know, Fran McDormand, she's so vulnerable, and she's having this, like, you know, this, like, scene with her like old high school friend, and it's like every scene like one after another is just like sort of ramping things up. It also takes place in a much shorter amount of time too. Like this movie, there's like, you know, obviously like the snow doesn't melt, we don't like get to the spring or anything like that, but it doesn't happen over this like very compressed period of time.
Yeah.
Which I think a lot of the Coen brothers movies do in general.
A Simple Plan doesn't have the Mike Yanagita scene, right? Like there is no like, you know, brief kind of like aside, and not to my recollection, at least, like there's nothing in this that is that sort of like, you know, very carefully observed, very funny, very kind of strange, like interstitial that happens in the film that serves like a thematic purpose, of course, but you know, that feels almost like removed from the rest of the milieu of the film.
Yeah, probably the closest thing to it is maybe when Becky Ann Baker comes in as Lou's wife, Nancy, like just mm-hmm. like the way that she stirs things up and just gives a performance that's really different from anything else in the movie. Like that feels like a little bit of an interjection, but like not really. And, you know, she's also dead within like five minutes or whatever. But it's a little bit more even keeled.
It reminded me of Drag Me into Hell a little bit, just in terms of it just being a film about, so you're greedy, you fuck up, and then everything that happens after you fuck up once, you know, and just the kind of, and in the end, it's like the trajectory of the characters is fully tragic, you know, it's like you made a mistake at the beginning of the story and it just keeps getting worse, like honestly.
Yeah, yeah. I was really struck by the line where Thorne says, am I just going to sit on the porch and drink and like try to not think about this? Like it is, it's very much like, yeah, it's like Mice and Men where the guy knows what's up.
Yeah. And I mean, like he has so many moments like that. I mean, when he reveals over the dinner when they've been drinking that, you know, he's like, you're an idiot if you don't think that our dad killed himself. Like you gotta stop living in this delusion. And just like all the revelations that Paxton goes through over the course of the film that just sort of like cut away at his self-perception. It's happening everywhere, right? Like it's just like it's a sequence of events where in the sort of, you know, moral tests that they go through around the money, Paxton's consistently failing. You know, he's the person who ends up smothering the farmer, and he's the one who ends up pulling the trigger all the time and really following through on like the evil deeds, like setting up the scenarios, coming up with the lies they're going to tell the cops. But then also in those scenes with Jacob, like he's getting his own sense of self eaten away at too. The first one when Thornton's like, oh, I just want the farm, you know, like when with the money, like I'm going to buy back this place and set it back up. And he reveals to Paxton, like the reason our dad like got fucked over and the reason he struggled with money wasn't because he was bad at business, it's because of you, because you needed to go to college and he paid for your tuition. And then, you know, the suicide revelation, all of this just keeps kind of like compounding and snowballing. And then I think, as we've already mentioned, like the real kind of thing that gets it rolling and the momentum going to a point of like, we know this is going to end horribly, is when Fonda finally does it too and says, like, you know, every little kind of like vestige of yourself that you believe in, everything that you think you know about yourself, all of it's just a lie. You're the only person who's actually occupying this fantasy. And so now you either get to break with it or just carry it to the end of the line. And they do ultimately, like you see that all come to play at the very end with even more bloodshed. You get, you know, Carl, the sheriff, murdered. Gary Cole's character gets killed too, which, you know, he probably should have. He's the accomplice who was involved in this whole kidnapping plot. But then he ends up pulling the trigger on his brother as well.
Carl, kind of a bozo though, not wanting to see the guy's badge. I mean, like you get like two guys showing up or one guy showing up as the, you know, just saying I'm FBI and you're going to just follow him around. And even when Paxton says like, did you see his badge? He's like, yeah, no, he's got a badge. Well, you know, I've seen a badge before, you know, not, not this one, but you know.
Yeah. I mean, top 10 anime betrayals right here, right? It's like, I can't believe this guy who just came in a suit with a gun in a holster who said he was FBI didn't end up being an FBI agent.
That scene where Paxton steals the gun out of the cupboard and there's, you can see the people and the reflections like through the glass and then the bullets don't fit. It's like
the bullets not fitting is so funny.
It's so killing.
I mean, it's so good though too. Like when he pulls open the drawer in the desk and you see like the single stray bullet kind of roll into frame. In a lesser film, this would be like, oh, there's, you know, there's
one bullet.
He's got one bullet. And then he tries to put it in the gun and doesn't fit. And you're like, this is what makes this special, is that like you feel for a second like, oh, I'm being manipulated by the script. I'm being manipulated by the kind of machinations of a film. And then it doesn't go his way. And you're like, okay, I'm glad that this was subverted, because that could have been that's a decision that I think really makes this more pronounced and more special.
When he grabs all of the like the big handful of bullets and puts in his jacket, and you're like, it's like not only is this not over, but you just know later in the movie he's gonna have to do it again.
Did you guys see the Blood Simple bullet holes in the side of the airplane too?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah,
right?
the light trails. Yeah.
I feel like that's overt. That's like an actual reference or like a sample. Don't you think?
Kind of a risky move for the guy to just shoot like indiscriminately into the plane. Although I guess maybe he just doesn't give a shit. Like maybe like he's going to kill him anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's like him just, you know, he's big dicking Paxton, where he's like, I could go into this plane myself, but like, you're going to go and get me the money. You go do it. Like go get it for me. And he's not really concerned whether or not he lives or dies at that point, because he's a goner.
Can we just talk about Bill Paxton JFK stuff for just 30 seconds?
Yes.
It's so weird, right?
Explain. Elaborate.
He was in Dallas. He met JFK the day he was shot. I think he might have been in the audience when it happened. I think he's a witness.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
I think he's on his dad's shoulders in Dallas the day that JFK is shot.
Huh. Is the Zapruder film on his IMDb?
Yeah, he shot the Zapruder film. He did it. His lensing. Yeah.
No, just like him in it. Like him being like,
is he in the Zapruder film? That might be his first. You're saying that's his first credit.
Yeah, uncredited.
Are you positing as well, Ray, that that Paxton's death may not have been completely natural?
God. Oh man, I love Bill Paxton. I really, there was something I think when it was like when he showed up in Edge of Tomorrow. That I especially just, I started to go back and like watch his movies again, like Near Dark. I'm trying to think, what are the other, like, he's just such Twister. An amazing actor. What'd you say?
Twister.
Oh, he's so good. Twister, man.
Fantastic. I mean, he's
so good.
Key in Aliens, you know, as Hudson.
Incredible, right? Just incredible. Yeah,
just fantastic.
Have you guys done Twister, by the way?
We have done Twister on the show. Yeah.
Okay.
Great one. Why I like to call it His Girl Dorothy, right? Because it is basically just a riff on the Howard Hawks film, but in the middle of like a disaster epic.
That's right.
But if you guys have not seen One False Move, the aforementioned Carl Franklin film, I think that that is one of his other finest hours. I just think he's very special. I miss him a lot. But I love watching Paxton perform.
He sells the grandeur of Titanic. I really think that it's so important, you know. He's really
and the story about the clam chowder with the PCP. You got to watch the video.
What's the story? Man. He tells the story really well.
Tells the story, yeah, about how someone put PCP in the clam chowder and everybody was freaking out, and then he was just like, I was at the hospital and then I was just like, I'm just going to get a 6-pack of beer and just ride this out.
He and Cameron, I guess, just like bought some beer and like went to the beach and just like watched waves and like got drunk. And I was like, that's the kind of guy you need in your corner when you get, you know, accidentally slipped some, well, very deliberately, but when you unknowingly ingest that much PCP.
There's got to be one of the greatest hangs in history.
Oh, absolutely. Right. And like, you know, you guys have hopefully seen the video too of them working on the Titanic documentary where Paxton is the guy who tells Jim Cameron when he comes up from the submersible that the Twin Towers had been hit. Like, he's the one who told him about the 9/11 attacks. And he's like, biggest terrorist attack in history, Jim. Something else. And it's like, yeah, that's the guy I would want to let me know that this was happening. They should have put him on national television.
It's very weird to see that scene because you buy every second of what this guy does in a movie. And then when you see similar cadence, just relating real life news, you're like, it's like something about it is just like uncanny.
Yeah. Yeah, it distances a little bit. It feels like he's like maybe performing in a script. It's so, there's such a naturalism to it that's like, for a minute, you're like, maybe the 9/11 attacks didn't really happen. Like, maybe you're just playing around here. But, you know, jury's still out. We're not really sure if they happened or not. We're getting really conspiratorial on this episode. We're talking about, you know, whether or not Paxton pulled the trigger on JFK. Talking about whether or not maybe he's made up the 9/11 attacks.
It didn't happen. Maybe, yeah. Or maybe it was... Maybe it was three towers or four towers.
Yeah, that's right.
Jim was underwater. Paxton. He has no idea.
And what did he know is the real question. You know, like he found himself on record and on video describing a lot of these, you know, kind of world shifting events. Curious why he's always at the center of this stuff.
I would like to point out there's one YouTube video of James Cameron telling the story about when he was on LSD and he had accidentally put a bunch of bullet shells into the bonfire that he was making while on LSD. And it's just him describing it like beat by beat and like what he had to do to survive and how he was tripping while it was happening. And it's like, it's basically like an Avatar sequence, you know? It's like really, really wonderful to hear him tell that story. It's easy to find on YouTube and highly recommend it.
Jacob? Hey, what are you doing here?
Look out!
Come on, what the hell did you drag me out here for?
Listen to this, I'm going to buy it back. I'm going to fix it up. I'm going to rebuild it just like it was before Mom and Dad died.
Whoa, come on, wait. We've been through all this. Yeah, we've been over this. Once we split up the money, we've got to leave. We have to go.
What do you want me to do? Just like that, just drive off by myself?
Well, I mean, suppose you stay. I mean, where are you going to tell people you got the money?
That's easy. We just tell people that Sarah inherited some money. It's easy. You know, nobody around here knows anything about her family. You guys could have just bought the farm, you know, and then left me to run it.
It's not going to work.
I thought this was going to make you happy.
Jacob. Farming? Come on. You don't just buy a farm. You gotta work it. You got to know about machinery and seed.
I know that.
No, you don't. Fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, drainage, irrigation, the weather. Come on, you don't know about any of that stuff. You're going to end up just like Dad.
Why do you think he ended up like that?
I'll tell you how he ended up like that. He had two mortgages riding on the place. He couldn't make the payments.
Where do you think the money went?
He was a bad businessman.
Where do you think the money went? No, you think he spent it all on the farm? I'll tell you exactly where the money went. 4 years of college, bud. Yeah, didn't you ever think about how he paid for that? Didn't that ever occur to you?
No, my tuition was...
Listen, I'm supposed to get the farm. What do I get? I'm supposed to get the farm.
Jacob, you got the whole world. You can...
I don't want to hear that.
You can go anywhere you want. This is where I want to be.
So here's a question for you all, as you know, the preeminent scholars and masters of all things Coen Brothers. Where does Fargo kind of rank for you guys in terms of like their whole canon? I'm not asking you to give me like a top five or anything here, but I just mean, where does it stand in your estimation as a work in their oeuvre?
Just could not be higher.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I think like I'm not a big ranker, but I would say like just judging from like bird's eye view, 100 years from now view, it's probably like Fargo or No Country, or maybe it's like Fargo is sort of the middle period and then No Country is like the sort of third act,
yeah,
top tier, and then maybe earlier on you have, I don't know, Raising Arizona, but like it's definitely like in the like, you know, like personally, like I don't really think any of them are like, I don't really think there's like a top shelf or a middle shelf, but in terms of the conversation, like if you were to list three of their movies, it's definitely going to be in that three.
The experience that I feel like me and Jordan that we are always having is because we watch multiple Coen's films every episode. So on the weeks where there is a Fargo scene like sorted in there with everything else, it's always this incredible wave hits you when the Fargo scene starts and you're suddenly watching that movie. And the other movies are great, are phenomenal. These are like my favorite movies, but when Fargo starts, it's just so confident. It's so like balanced. It's so immediate, you know? You're really just right there with the characters, and it's doing artsy moves, but it's just clean. It's just a clean movie, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and as an objective metric, every time I lay out like four scenes from a Coen Brothers movie, the Fargo scene is always the shortest.
Yes.
And not by a little.
Yes.
It's like big rectangle. Like minute and 20 second chunk that feels just as multi-layered and complex as any other one of their scenes, but it's tight. It's like it's an unbelievably concise and like you know.
I think we have an angle on that because we keep pulling out these scenes based on prisms, you know, so there's like a similarity. There's a dynamic that the Coens are achieving in all these scenes. So you watch how much they have to build up in order to pay it off in their other films. And you watch Fargo and you're like, God, they're moving just with like clarity and precision and they're completely themselves. I don't know. It feels like such a personal film in that it's like about where they grew up, but it's also like so much like the core of what they just want to make Blood Simple type movies, you know? Mm-hmm. It's really honestly like it's a back to basics film and a back to your hometown movie. And it's just like they just don't miss in that film. They just don't miss.
Yeah. I was so struck watching it last night by just how, as you're both mentioning, how succinct it is, how like kind of exacting it is and precise with its beats, and also just how confidently and how deliberately it feels designed, edited, rhythmically composed to play to an audience. And like as I was watching it, I was just like, you know, I was just having a blast with it, and I was like, man, this beat is going to kill the crowd. Like this part would just like absolutely kill. Like they even pause for a moment to give the audience like a chance to like, not like a Marvel movie, you know, where like they like stop for like 90 seconds so that the audience can cheer when Blurko shows up or whatever. But like, you know, like you get those kind of like rhythmic beats in the performance where like, this is very crafted and theatrical, where it's like, they know this is the point where people are going to laugh. They know this is the point where people are going to kind of gasp and you know, express their shock. It's just like, I don't know. It's very just immaculately crafted in that regard. I think it's really brilliant.
I think I had one of like what I would maybe describe as like my first adult movie viewing experiences seeing that movie in theaters.
Yeah.
Where I just felt like I was holding my breath the entire time. Like I remember coming out of it just being like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like I'd love to see it on the big screen right now. Like,
I think we need to make that happen. You guys control Hollywood. So, we, you know, get it figured out, get it onto some big screen sometime soon.
Yes, we do.
So I've got one more thing to kind of talk about as it pertains to A Simple Plan and to the Coens and all this kind of stuff. And it's kind of a weird question to ask, but I consider this a lot when looking at the works of the Coens, like, you know, in a macro sense. Do you all consider Joel and Ethan Coen to be conservative filmmakers? I don't mean stylistically. I mean maybe like politically or like ideologically. Do you find them to be conservatives?
I know there's a take on this. Jordan, didn't you bring up this take? This is like definitely exists on the internet, right?
Sorry, I don't have a strong
dismissive.
It was from my tweets probably, right? Where I was just like, that's what Jordan was bringing up.
I don't have a strong answer for that. I know I will say that a friend of me and Griffin, Colin Beckett, is a future guest that I want to have on the show because he's an academic sort of writer and has a real specific take on this. So like the honest answer is I want to talk to my friend Colin about it and then get back to you.
I feel like they're Midwestern boomers, and so is Sam Raimi. Maybe that's a little bit of a way of positioning them, you know, where they're like, I think they're definitely like compared to some of their other peers. They're artsy and they live in New York and they're liberals, you know. But then also just, you know, they're pretty old at this point. So I do think that like, especially if, and they're interested in morality tales and they're interested in things where characters get punished on screen. So I think that all like boomer, morality tales, like interested in seeing pain, like what leads to pain, you know, that definitely is like a lot of stories where you're like, and also a willingness to like make you fall in love with characters that then suffer, you know, which I think often just makes people feel strange and they start to try to find like a political meaning underneath it to make it feel less strange, where it's like a genuinely weird thing that the Coens do where they'll get you very, very invested in a character and then make them hit like a really bad end in a very kind of unsentimental way. And I think at that point, audiences start to go like, oh, there must be like a thesis here or something. So this can feel good. You know?
Yeah. I think I agree with both of you to a certain extent. I think, you know, and when I say that, by the way, like, because there are occasions where I'll say like, oh yeah, like, you know, comparatively, and like there are definitely readings of a lot of Coen brothers' works that could read and, you know, kind of ring as conservative, not reactionary, but just like distinctly kind of embedded within the fibers of a particular kind of just ideology, an ideological kind of project. I don't mean it in a pejorative way at all. I think that, you know, if they are, they, you know, stand as like some of the great surveyors and some of the great kind of like creators of conservative art. I put like Clint Eastwood up in that category as well. You know, one of my favorites.
I went and saw The Holdovers because I wanted to make sure I saw that in theaters. And they had a trailer for Drive Away Dolls, which I think has been slightly edited from the one that we saw back when it was going to come out in October. And there's just the line where one of the girls says, "We're Democrats." and I don't know the context of that, but it does feel like maybe the Coens are Democrats.
Yeah.
That's just like, that's kind of the long and the short of it in terms of their political, you know, their like literal political space on the map is like, they're Democrats.
For sure. I think, you know, like blue dogs, perhaps, you know, maybe is what we consider them. And I only ask because I find a compelling thread here between Fargo and between A Simple Plan that, again, is more a curio to me, more fascinating than it is me trying to level any sort of like judgment of these films. The sort of reification in rate and torification of
hell yeah,
a particular kind of American ideal in Fargo. I think that Marge represents to me, you know, a very certain kind of aw shucks mentality, but like a genuine goodness, right? Like these are people who the Coens are looking at with a clear perspective on their capacity, their sort of like way of retaining their goodness in the face of incomprehensible evil. But also to like, you know, that idea of money not being everything, of, you know, like this person being contented with a particular kind of very simple, inelegant type of lifestyle. And what I find compelling about A Simple Plan is that it muddies that up. Yes, you know, it kind of tries to examine the corruptibility of that sort of Midwestern nice persona, but it's also infinitely more concerned with and skeptical of like all of these sort of systemic machinations that lead to the precarity that all these characters are feeling, the things that would drive them to do what it is that they're doing. It's just an observance that I made, and I was finding that kind of fascinating, how, especially watching Fargo afterward, how little of that is there. Like there's some, you know, kind of, you know, gestures towards Macy's character having some sort of like unacknowledged and unspecified debt.
You get the sense that he probably did that himself.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like systemic. On the other hand, I think Inside Llewyn Davis has a little bit more cognizance of, like, you know, people on the margins, you know, not having a proper winter coat. It's different. Like, I mean, like, I come back to the "you work for the American dream, you don't steal it" line in this movie. And, like, I just don't think you would have the main character in a Coen Brothers movie say that. Like, if somebody was going to say it, it would probably be more like the Big Lebowski guy, or like Papio Daniel or something would say that. Like,
sure.
And I'm not even saying that either movie is actually taking that as read as, like, the moral center of the movie, but it just feels like the way that that line is delivered by the main character just feels like a different approach to talking about stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marge kind of says something akin to it at the very end of Fargo, you know, when she's got Stormar in the back of the car. And she says that thing, you know, where she's like, "You did all of this just for money, you know, and here you are. And it's a beautiful day. You know, I just don't understand it. I can't comprehend why you would do all of this just for, like, a little bit more of the pie."
But that's so much more of a subtle and,
like, I completely agree. And line. I think it's yeah, lovely. And you know, you're mystified by it in the moment. Like, it's only maybe afterward where you start to maybe kind of poke and prod at the ideology behind it. I don't know that there really is. I think the thing that makes the Coens so singular and special is that they often transcend, as you mentioned, Ray, like, all those very simplistic ideas of coherent ideology, especially within, like, a socio-political perspective, that a lot of times it manages to transcend and become something far more, like, existential, like, mythological almost. And that's why, to me, it always ends up striking such a profound tenor.
Mythological is a really interesting way of putting it. If this film is like a roller coaster that really puts you in the kind of experience of these characters trying to survive, finding this money and what it does to them, it's like, yeah, the Coens films, just thinking about, like, Fargo and thinking about Man Who Wasn't There in relation to this, and even Man Who Wasn't There, which is about a guy trying to get a scheme going and it ends up in him dying, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, they're not at every moment. There's tension. There's definitely, like, when he's meeting Gandolfini, you're like, what does Gandolfini know? Like, what's about to happen? But the film does operate in more of a mythological space than a what's going to happen next kind of space.
Yeah, and their films always throw in that kind of the incomprehensibility of existence, right? Like, yeah, they kind of gesture towards it a lot. You mentioned already in Man Who Wasn't There, the alien kind of reveal at the end of that feature. Which sort of feels like a test run of the ending of A Serious Man as well.
They're dialectical too.
Yes.
Like, they're mythological, but they're also dialectical.
Yep.
So it's like in Hail Caesar, you've got all the stuff about religion and what is God. God is split. And then you have the communists who are also saying man is split, but they're atheists, right? So it's like, they're very careful if they're talking about philosophical concepts to have, like, different ends of the spectrum all kind of speak for themselves. Maybe some of them are a little bit silly, and maybe you're not supposed to, again, like, take what they're saying as a given or as read, but like the movies feel like they're, like, about something, and not in, like, an overly showy way. Mm-hmm. But, like, they kind of have those conversations.
Well, with all that said and done, A Simple Plan, fantastic Raimi film. Go out, seek it out, watch it for the first time, for the 10th time, whatever. It's always fantastic. I enjoyed it immensely. Getting a chance to revisit it, especially to be able to do so and talk to you two fellas, Jordan Fish and Ray Tintori. Thank you both so very much.
Thank you. This was a blast. This was a total pleasure.
It's such a treat to have you guys, you know, behind the scenes here. You guys came on very last minute on my request. You all were consummate professionals about it. I was not. I very much appreciate your time for it. And with that, I guess, where can we find you guys around the internet, what you all do? Tell us a little bit about To the White Sea. Maybe I'll let Jordan take care of that.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Oh. No, go.
Check out Jordan's music video for MGMT and the one that I'm directing right now. I'm going to go.
See you, Ray.
Ray's got to hop off. I could give you a little spiel on the show as well. And I appreciate the plug. So the story of the show is it's called To the White Sea. It's named after a screenplay called To the White Sea, which they wrote based on a James Dickey novel also called To the White Sea. And it's a World War II movie that would have been set mostly in Japan. It would have starred Brad Pitt. And they got deep, deep into production. On our show, we talked to the storyboard artist, and we found out that they had already like boarded the whole movie. And then shortly after 9/11, the whole thing got shut down. And so our show is kind of asking the question, why did that happen? And then like, what can we do to try to like reconstruct this movie that didn't happen? Every episode, we read two pages from the screenplay, and then we pick what we call a prism to discuss their work in relation to that prism. So we've done episodes about sneaking. We've done episodes about act breaks. We've done episodes about budget destroying effects. So rather than going film by film, we try to kind of go like, what do you call it? Like cross multi longitudinal. There's got to be a word, something like that.
If there is, I don't have it, but I think that that's a good one. Cross multi longitudinal.
Yeah. We're a cross multi longitudinal prismatic podcast about the Coen brothers. Check it out.
Fantastic. Co-signed on that. Check it out there. I get in trouble sometimes with friends and fans of the show and anyone on the internet that I mention this to, but for a movie podcaster, I don't listen to that many movie podcasts with regularity. But you all, Jordan Ray at To the White Sea, are one of the ones that I do, because you all have just a fascinating perspective, a lot of insider knowledge just because of your craft. And you're talking about some filmmakers and a filmography that I am very passionate about and love dearly and sincerely. So check them out. We'll make sure to link in the show descriptions so that you all can follow along with the program and start from the beginning with that one for sure, because it's kind of a read along, also an exploration of a script and a filmography that definitely requires, I think, like a kind of beat by beat.
Thank you, Aaron. And likewise, a huge Hit Factory fan, a huge fan of you and Carly and everything that you're doing and your analysis of the 90s and like the way you call it an infinite well or a seemingly infinite well of content. You know, as somebody who grew up and kind of found my interest in movies in the 90s when movies were coming out, and then going back and either watching things I hadn't seen or reapproaching them now and comparing it to like my experience of seeing them back when I was a kid. It's a really fun show, and I'm, you know, was super honored to be on it. And I know Ray was as well.
Well, thank you very much to both you and Ray. From our end of things, you can follow along with the show at Hit Factory Pod. That's Twitter. That's Instagram. We are also sort of on Blue Sky, though I have not posted there in probably like 2 months, because what's the point anymore? They kind of dropped the ball with that one. By any means, we also have a Patreon, patreon.com/HitFactoryPod, where for $5 a month, you can subscribe and get the full Hit Factory experience. You also get invited to the Hit Factory Discord, where Mr. Jordan Fish is a regular sort of member. He's in the chat having conversations with us, talking shit, sharing glass bricks, sharing the most recent Blu-ray purchases that go onto our shelves. It's all really happening in the Discord.
Who needs Blue Sky when you got Blu-rays?
That's right.
And Discord.
Absolutely. You want to be in the Discord. It's all happening. It's a total blast. And you get an invitation along with your subscription to the show with all that biweekly bonus content. If you're listening to this, you are likely already a member of our Patreon, or you have a very generous friend who has pirated the show for you. I can't imagine that we have too many of those yet. But if we do, thank you for your service, ? Get your friends to give us their money. I will give a shout out to our overlords, Linda and Jared Murray. Thank you for your continued support of the program. And we will catch you all next week. See you, everyone.
I might be a part of this ripple on water from a lonesome trip, a fallen tree that witnessed me. I'm alone here. life itself could not aspire to have someone be so admired. I threw creation to my kin with a silence broken by a whispered wind. All of this can be broken, all of this can be broken. Hold your devil by his throat and spin him to the ground. And root to root and tip to tip, I look at him, my country jip, leathered up by all his fears, but someone brought you close to tears. Many trains and many miles brought you to me on this sunny isle. And what of which you wish to speak? Have you come here to rescue me? All of this can be broken, all of this can be broken. Hold your devil by his spoke and spin him to the ground. But the love of your life lives but lies no more.